Welcome to the Dungeon Plunger Podcast. My name is Jason Weeb, and this is the show in which I, a real-life janitor and dungeon master, teaches you how to plunge in and run a better Dungeons & Dragons game. Without further ado, let's plunge into this week's episode, Playing God. Hit it! Welcome, Dungeon Plunger Union members, to another episode. Well, another week has passed, and it's time for me to tell you all the cool stuff that I've been doing. And let me tell you guys, I have had a pretty rad week, and I'm going to tell you why. So first up, I listened to this amazing podcast by Runeslinger called Casting Shadows. I put a link in the show notes for that. Basically, this episode was him going over, he calls it the Call of Cthulhu Cliff Notes of a multi-pronged campaign. Well, he calls them branches, which I think is really smart. But basically, a open table investigation by different groups of investigators. And oh man, it's so cool. It's been going on for a pretty long time. And just listening to the kind of creativity that's gone into this, it's pretty compelling. So I highly recommend that you give that a listen to. In addition, I got to work. And usually the first thing I do is I have a cup of coffee. Because, you know, you can't start your day without a cup of Joe. As I'm drinking my coffee, scrolling through my phone, and I was like, hey, you know what? I'm just going to give a quick look at Facebook Marketplace. You know, you can always find some cool deals on things there. What was the first thing that showed up but none other than a H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society Masks of Narlahotep prop set. Never been used. And let me tell you, I got it at an amazing price. In fact, not only that, but the seller was also selling the first edition Aliens RPG. And so I managed to pick up a good chunk of alien stuff from Free League for basically the price that it would have cost me to get the masks prop set, brand new and shipped. I got the main core aliens book, Colonial Marines, the starter set, and the Destroyer of Worlds and GM screen. I was pretty stoked about that. So all in all, it was a great haul, and I looked through the masks box and the props are so worth it. When you see people doing an unboxing online, it really doesn't do it justice. So I'm really, really excited to, like, you know, more than ever to get this masks game happening. And the more that I've read the campaign, I'm almost finished the second book now. I'm almost finished the Australia chapter. And then I just got China left. And then the rest of it is really like tables and whatnot, indexes. I can really, really see how this game is such a powerful tool, you know, just because really you can play it in any kind of order with the exception of being like Peru and America, even though they do give you, you know, options for like how to end in America, which just seems kind of weird because that's kind of how the, you know, the campaign kicks off. But supposing you wanted to do a little bit of a shuffle, you know, the option exists. The other thing that was really cool this week is that I received finally one of my Kickstarters that I did, the Perilous Void, which is a companion in, you know, so to speak, of the Perilous Wilds. And this book, it's super thick. It's a nice, like, I guess A5 size. We're looking at about 167 pages, and it's just full of tables for all sorts of stuff. Just look at the table of contents here. You can hear, oops, sorry. All right, so yeah, we got like an introduction, we got overviews, so like how is the book organized. We got setting creation tables. We got sector creation tables, system creation, basically for, you know, all the different little planets. So system population, population development, satellite, asteroids, blah, blah, blah. World creation, life form creation, society creation, faction creation, and community creation. Like, this book is perfect if you wanted to add it to your Stars Without Numbers. Like he says here in the inspiration, it says, these works have had significant influence on the development of Perilous Void. H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, Ray Bradbury's Martian Chronicles, Dune, Star Trek, Traveler, the Ready Ref sheets from Judges Guild, which is pretty rad, Star Wars, except he only includes the first three, which, I mean, okay, whatevs, and Starfleet, which I've never heard of this. It looks like it's a game. The Left Hand of Darkness, Ursula K. Le Guin, which I really need to, like, read. Ursula K. Le Guin. Barlow's Guide to Extraterrestrials. This also seems like one of those classic books. I've never read it, but I mean, it feels like one of those things that you got to get your hands on if you're into that sort of, you know, jam. And then we got Master of Orion, which I have no idea what that is. No Man's Sky, which I think is a video game. Stars Without Numbers and Starforge. So clearly, you know, he had those games in mind when he was putting this together. And so that was part of the reason, being somebody that plays science fiction stuff, I was like really, really excited to get this book. Really well put together. Talking about Kickstarters, this month has been like really crazy for Kickstarters. There was the Shadow Dark, there's Castle Zagig, and there was the Aliens Second Edition Kickstarter. And I wanted to back all of them. Unfortunately, I backed none of them, mostly due to how much the price is for everything. All of them are like really expensive. Quite frankly, I'm really seriously considering how I'm spending my money these days. And not to mention with how global economics is right now, we'll leave it at that part. Who knows how much those things will cost when it comes to shipping and printing and everything like that afterwards. I just didn't want to be involved. I'm really bummed about that. I even wanted to get the Castle Zagig PDF, but $80 for a PDF. And I get it. I get that, you know, they're trying to make money for, you know, the Gary Gygax Foundation or whatever it is. But I'm sorry, I can't justify spending that much on a PDF. The stuff that I have backed. So for Kickstarter, there's a few things that I'm still waiting for. So I backed Xeno Salvage, which is a science fiction, Shadow Dark compatible set of rules from Stella Gamma Publishing by Omer Golan-Joel. This guy has put out like a ton of really good stuff. I really like Stella Gamma. They're really cool. A lot of like Cepheus Engine compatible stuff. So I'm excited for that. I'm still waiting for the Ashes Without Numbers hardcover to come. That's basically the Wastelands post-apocalyptic sandbox campaign book. So that'll be pretty awesome. Then I got the Deadlands Abominable Northwest, which I've just been sort of like collecting a lot of the Deadlands stuff. So basically the classic Deadlands, you know, the Weird West, and then the other one is Deadlands Lost Colony. Those are the two sort of versions of Deadlands that I'm really into. And at some point I hope that they do the suede version of Hell on Earth, and, you know, get a print of the book in their graphic novel. I'm not really sure what the size is. This is not A5. They're like, it's a weird size of book. It's sort of like in between the big 8.5 by 11s versus the A5, which I don't even know what that is in, you know, sizing. But anyway, yeah, so if they eventually do that, I would back that. I'm also waiting for Monsters of Drakenheim. Yeah, so I do have Sebastian Crowe's Guide to Drakenheim and the Drakenheim main book, Dungeons of Drakenheim. It's a pretty cool setting. I really like it. At some point, I plan to run a campaign on that. It's made for 5th edition. I don't know. We'll see like what I'll run it in. And then from Backer Kit, I'm waiting for the Deadlands Lost Colony Mad World. This is basically like sort of the space futuristic kind of version of Deadlands. I have the main core book for Deadlands Lost Colony. These are sort of like an adventure plot point campaigns. From Goodman Games, I backed their Terror of the Underdeep box. This one, I don't know, it felt like it's 4.5e, but it really felt like a throwback to Against the Giants, the Descent into the Depths kind of campaign. It just looked really, really cool. Goodman Games puts out really cool stuff. I don't back everything that they do, but this one looked like something that I was really interested in. I'm also waiting for Mothership Wages of Sin. Mothership, pretty cool game. In fact, tonight I will be playing an awesome Mothership game again, continuing Descent into the crazy Prospero's Dream space station. It's a pretty crazy, but having a lot of fun with that game. Also waiting for Trail of Cthulhu 2nd Edition. Never played the Gumshoe system. You know, I have the Dracula dossier and, yeah, Knights Black Agents. I have that. I've never played it. Always wanted to. And finally, I'm waiting for Scions of the Dark Goddess, which is a modern Call of Cthulhu campaign by Shadowlands Games. I'd never heard of Shadowlands Games, but this looked like the production values looked really, really high. And normally, I don't back Kickstarters from companies that I don't really know. I've had great success in the Kickstarters that I've backed, or the backer kit, whatever you want to call it. I've never had one that hasn't delivered yet. I had one that came very, very close. Quite frankly, I'll never back them again just because of how long it took for them to come out with their product. And it wasn't cheap. And so I kind of have this policy, like, if I don't know the company, I'm, you know, less likely to want to take the risk. Anyway, that's where I'm at. I feel like unless something really, really cool comes out, that's probably it for me for the next foreseeable future until things on the economic front start to look up, just because I can't take these financial hits. And quite frankly, I'm on the Audio Dungeon Discord, and Ray Otis posed a really good question. And he was basically like, listen, let's say, you know, your house burned down, heaven forbid, and, you know, the insurance covered all of the things that you needed to, like, recover your necessities, but you had $300 to sort of restart your RPG collection. Like, what would you get? And it really made me think, like, when I look at the amount of material that I have, like, I have 3 bookshelves packed, overflowing, and I say to myself, like, I probably only need, I don't know, 1/100th of what I have in terms of books, less than a little box. I maybe need, like, maybe 3 books, and even then, you know, so I think this, you know, RPG consumerism and the FOMO is something that I really need to take a look at and go, hey, is this something that I want or something that I need? And really, when it comes to RPGs, like, what do we need? Yeah, I think I'm going to be taking a little better look and being a little more thoughtful in what I buy going forward. All right, so next up, let's plunge in to the Mimic Mailbox and see what we got. First of all, I got calls from Carl, Che, and Joe Richter from Hindsightless, and I got a big apology for Carl because he had sent in a phone call and I accidentally missed it, and so it didn't get on the last show. Carl Rodriguez, I apologize from the depths of my heart. Hope you can find it in your heart to forgive me. But without further ado, let's listen to what Carl has to say.
Hey, Jason. Carl here. Man, when I heard that fake it till you make it, I kind of gritted my teeth, maybe growled a little bit. It's kind of one of those things that they say in the office, and I kind of hate cliches in general. But it did get me to thinking, right, especially thinking about your professional journey and how mine has changed, right, from being in a comfortable academic job to now doing finances, which is totally different here later in my life, some like 10 to 15 years from retirement. You wouldn't expect that, right, that sudden change, but here it is. And I think, right, it makes you think about reevaluating how you do things, how you approach gaming, right? So for the longest time, for example, I was like, oh, actual play, yuck. But, you know, you got to change, you got to evolve, you got to promote, I guess it seems, or even the way one GMs from being, I would say, early in my Pathfinder 3.5 career, maybe being adversarial or wanting to save that NPC, and then somewhere along the way, it kind of evolved, especially maybe when on the opposite side, you're like, man, that villain shouldn't get away because we got him legit, right? So then your GMing evolves to what it's become today, more of a yes and type of GM. I think that's the term that you and Jason were looking for, but I probably told him that too. Anyway, I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much for your call, Carl. I really appreciate it. And again, I apologize for losing your call in the mailbox. But you know, sometimes that happens. Mimic mailboxes. Not only do they eat mailmen, but sometimes they eat messages. And then sometimes the guy who makes that podcast is just a little bit incompetent. Touching on some of the things he said, fake it till you make it. Dude, I hear you. And I 100% agree that sometimes these cliches are quite grating and frustrating to hear. Sometimes there's power to them. You know, sometimes we need that shorthand to sort of get an idea across. Unfortunately, I felt this one was sort of apropos. In terms of changing professions, I had no idea that you had changed, and I congratulate you on making such a change in your life. It's not easy, especially as we get older. It becomes more difficult in our mind in particular, but mostly because change is scary. And we know what we have, and we don't necessarily want to give it up. I salute you for making such a change in your life. And you're right. Things like this do cause us to reevaluate and really reflect on what do we want from life? What do we want from our gaming? So yeah, when you talk about how like, yeah, actual play, what's up with that? That's kind of how I felt about solo play. I was kind of like, why would you want to play by yourself? That sounds really sad. And now I see the power of solo play, you know, and I see the power of a lot of other things in my life, and you know, unrelated to gaming. And it's because we do need to take that step back and really look at, you know, how we do things. And I think you're right. Yes, and as a GM skill is vital. Thank you very much for the call. I hope I didn't turn you off from wanting to call in again, but I really, really appreciate it. Let's hit our next caller. The next call is from Che Webster of Roleplay Rescue. He had called also before, but I put this one in my back pocket. I wanted to make sure that I had at least one phone call that I could play for this week. So I apologize, Che, for holding this one back, but I really do appreciate the call. And let's hear what Che has to say.
Hey, weeb, it's Che from Roleplay Rescue. Just a quick call in really regarding improvisation. And I think that two things are worth bearing in mind. One is a piece of advice from Runeslinger, aka Anthony, from Casting Shadows, which is prepare to improvise. And alongside that, I would place the Alexandrian's advice to don't prep plots, prep situations. That's what I mean. Well, on the one hand, do your prep, set up your situations, set up the places, the locations, whatever you need, you feel that you need. But also along with that, take Anthony's advice and be aware that how that's going to play out is totally open in a cool role-playing game. Don't have a plot in your mind of how it's going to run through. Just set up the situations, different things that are there. Have all the moving parts ready to go, and then be prepared to improv how it all plays out in response to the player characters themselves. So for me, that's like having the stats of bad guys in case there's going to be a fight, knowing the maps, knowing locations, knowing what people want, and more importantly, knowing the motivations of your opposition to your PCs. And they have, like you said, lists of names and things like that are all great. So you can improv as much as you need to at the table. But ultimately, just be ready for anything, and at the same time, ready for nothing in particular. And that probably sounds pretty cryptic, but it's the best advice I've got. Game on, brother.
Thank you so much for the call, Che. I really appreciate you calling in and offering your advice on improv. I feel like those are two excellent sources, Runeslinger and the Alexandrian, both great game masters and great places to get advice from. 100% agree, Runeslinger's Prepare to Improvise is super valid. Also, I really like the Alexandrian's Don't Prep Plots, situations, just because back in the day when I was creating adventures and scenarios, I always felt like I needed to have the solution to solve the problem. And that always hung me up because I was like, what is the solution and how do I provide that solution to my players? There was much gnashing of teeth trying to figure out how to do that. And finally, when came on that idea, probably from the Alexandrian, about, you know, you don't need to have the solution. The players are going to come up with their own solution. They're going to come up with their own unique ideas about how to deal with the situation. So your job is just to give them that problem and let them figure out how they're going to figure it out. I also agree with the NPCs having motivations. If you understand what the motivations of your NPCs are, how they're going to react to what the players do and say is so much easier at that point. And I think it's probably one of the most underspoken about topics when it comes to creating game sessions, especially for games that are very NPC focused. You know, modern games, investigations, horror scenarios. These are games where we're not exploring dungeon rooms. The problems that we're trying to get past tend to be people-based. Why did the murderer do what he did? You know, what was his motivation for doing it? What is the bad guy's end goal? Or if you're playing cyberpunk, you know, we don't necessarily need to go in and kill everybody. Maybe we can blackmail somebody or that kind of stuff. So yeah, 100% agree. The not trying to force the solution or the end game that you think is there, I think is also very important. And especially when it comes to like pre-published adventures, because, you know, we're given all of this stuff that's written down and we sort of say, oh, well, it's written down and this is how the designer expected the game to go. And really, when it comes down to it, it's like once that scenario that was pre-written comes to you, it's now it belongs to the table. Now it belongs to you and your players. And that person who wrote it has no more power over what happens at that game. And it's all about what your players decide to do in the end. And trying to sort of force your own particular vision, however subtle that might be, players tend to figure that out. So I agree. It's better to just let the players do it and let the dice fall the way they will. So great call. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. All right. So we got another call from Joe Richter from Hindsightless. This one was based off of the last episode, A Blood-Curdling Tale. So let's hear what Joe has to say.
Yo, what up, Jason? Just got finished listening to your latest episode, A Blood-Curdling Tale. First off, I just want to say, I haven't mentioned it before, and I keep meaning to, so I'll mention it now. I really, really appreciate all the effort you put into producing your show. It's basically the exact opposite of mine, and I love it, man. I love your music. I love your sound effects. I love your voice. It's just a fantastically put together show, so thank you for that. Yeah, dude, I loved the movie Army of Darkness, though I wish they would have gone with the original title Medieval Dead, but they went with Army of Darkness, and honestly, that was that my first... That could have been my first introduction to Lovecraft, though I think I was introduced to it in maybe an intro for a Stephen King book where he talked about Lovecraft, possibly. I can't really remember now, but yeah, dude, I freaking love Army of Darkness. It's such a fun movie, and oh my God, man, when you were telling that story about being in the Western Civ class. Before you even got to what you said, I was just like, oh, no. Because I saw where it was going. And then you said you raised your hand. And I was like, no. Oh, my God, man. I'm so glad nobody in the class knew what you were talking about. That could have been a much worse situation. But anyway, dude, awesome episode. Yeah, man. Oh, and then as far as why people would run masks of Nyarlathotep in particular multiple times, I would say because more than a lot of campaigns, granted, I've never run it, but from what I heard, more than a lot of campaigns, you can run it in so many different ways that it leads to so many different outcomes and storylines. And it's not really the same campaign run multiple times. It's like different versions, you know? It's so different depending on which location you go to first, second, third, what clues you follow up with from those locations. That's why I think people run it multiple times, because it flows differently each time you run it, which that sounds awesome. Like, as far as an adventure module goes or a campaign, like, what more could you want? A campaign that you could get multiple playthroughs out of? Like, you know, I'm running Wrath of the Righteous for Pathfinder. Would I run it again? I don't know if I'd run it again, but if I did, it would basically be more or less the same. Obviously, the characters would be different. Some interactions with NPCs and stuff would be different. But overall, it'd basically be the same campaign. But in Mass, from what I hear, it could be a totally, totally different campaign. So I think that's probably why people run it multiple times. And because it's, you know, people say it's one of the greatest campaigns of all time. So anyway, man, that's it for me. You take it easy, Jason. Have a good one. Peace out.
Hey, Joe, thank you so much for your call. And dude, I super appreciate the compliment. I really try my best to make this thing sound great. And to have somebody give me a compliment like that is super appreciated. And you know what, dude? I love your raw dog in it, the way you run your podcast. I love the guerrilla podcasting. It's got its flavor. I think, you know, you do it well. I love how when you play your calls, it's like you literally like listening to the call and recording it at the same time as you're, you know, I love hearing your voice laughing in the background. And so, yeah, you made me laugh out loud for real when you talked about my story for the Western Civ class. Yeah, dude, super embarrassing, super, super embarrassing. And, you know, after listening to your call when you're talking about running masks of Nyarlathotep multiple times, I've really come around. Like I said, I've almost finished reading the entire campaign now, and I can really, really see how each chapter is interchangeable so that you could run it in different orders and have an ending in, you know, very satisfying in each different chapter. I'm still not 100% convinced that you'd be able to do that in the Peru or the America chapter. I really feel like those are integral to like starting the game off, but the other ones, England, Egypt, Kenya, Australia, and China, I mean, I can really see how those ones could really go in any order and then you could end it. And I agree with your comment how Pathfinder Adventure Paths sort of lack that replayability. You know, I really wonder, like, what if Paizo took a different sort of approach where they were more modular in terms of like how they play and that they're a little less linear? Granted, it's been a very long time since I've looked at the newer APs, so maybe they do this. I don't know. I feel like there's definitely some great, great Pathfinder adventure paths, but they definitely, you know, quite frankly, I don't even know how many campaign settings out there have, you know, the like what Masks of Nyarlathotep has in terms of, you know, the replayability. Perhaps something like Night Below, maybe, because it is a more modular sort of a campaign. But yeah, so I just want to say thank you very much for the call. I really appreciate it. And I hope you enjoy and continue to enjoy the rest of the show. And we'll talk to you later, dude. And lastly, I got a letter And this is what inspired this episode. So let's read what this letter has to say. Hey Jason, I just finished listening to episode 8, and I really liked it. I think hearing the fact that one of your former DMs was able to create a day of D&D just by picking out a monster got me thinking of potentially creating a campaign story in the future, like a whole story with its own rules and encounters and NPCs. I'm not sure if this is the right place to ask, however, but I was wondering if you had any ideas on how to go about creating a campaign from scratch. Like, what would I need to include in the package? How should I go about dealing damage, etc.? You're doing a great job out there, and you're killing it on the podcast. Keep up the hard work. All the best wishes, Jim Robert Jones. Well, Jim Robert Jones, JRJ, thank you so much for the letter. I really appreciate it. I'm glad that you're enjoying the show. I have decided to dedicate the main topic of this episode to you in order to answer this question. So thanks for inspiring this episode, dude. And I hope that this answers your question. So strap in and let's get ready to play God.
Let's get it on.
Welcome to the main topic, playing God. Quote, "The creation of a thousand forests is in one acorn," end quote, by Ralph Waldo Emerson. Could you imagine going through life and people are like, "Dude, what's your name?" And you're like, "My name's Ralph Waldo Emerson." And people are like, "Seriously? Like, you just couldn't have gone with Ralph or Emerson? You had to throw the Waldo in there?" Maybe Waldo was like a really cool name back in the day, and we've just sort of lost the plot, you know? I mean, maybe it's just because they had those Where's Waldo books, and now I can't take anybody with the name Waldo seriously. But nonetheless, I think that Ralph Waldo Emerson had an excellent point in what he was saying in this particular quote. So let's delve into story time here. Way back in the day, in 3rd edition D&D, I created my very first world. I had run a bunch of games before, but nothing that I felt particularly proud of. I was sort of trying to find my feet as a game master. And I had run a few scenarios of the classic Deadlands, which for me was just a little above my head. I really enjoyed the setting, but the rules I found were a little difficult for me to grasp. And quite frankly, I always had difficulty with rules as I was beginning my gaming career. I was more interested in the role-playing and the storytelling and the doing stuff than I was in how the rules worked. And I was always intimidated by the rules, and it took me a long time to get over that. I had also written and run a modern Call of Cthulhu scenario that was based on Herbert West Reanimator and the movie The Thing that was set in the Arctic, and that was pretty cool. And I really enjoyed Call of Cthulhu because the percentile system was very, very easy to understand and utilize. But when 3rd edition came out, I was determined that I was going to run a campaign. And the rules of 3rd edition just made sense to me. Not everything. There was still a lot that I really didn't understand. But the general concepts were pretty clear to me. And I picked up and ran The Sunless Citadel, written by Bruce Cordell, one of my favorite authors of the time. And quite frankly, this scenario will always have a special place in my heart. I love this adventure, and it, you know, it has problems in it that I wasn't able to recognize then. And perhaps maybe it's just because I've changed in how I approach gaming today. But it was that scenario that would be the catalyst for me to create my first world. And in doing so, I stole a ton of stuff from The Dragonbone Chair by Tad Williams. Also, I was using ideas that I'd taken from these old school black and white, big, huge Marvel Conan comics, and a little bit of H.P. Lovecraft. I got myself a piece of graph paper and I drew this map of the continent. That was probably inspired from Lord of the Rings and the map of the Hyborian Age that was in the Conan comic. And it always struck me as kind of funny how anytime you would read any of these huge fantasy epic novels like the Wheel of Time series or whatever, they always had a continent. It was very rarely that you would see a world map. It was always just a continental map. That probably has something to do with Tolkien and Lord of the Rings. Anyway, I placed cities and villages on the map, and I marked where the monsters and other races lived. So I had a place for dwarves, and I had a place for the elves, and the geography was all wrong. I had mountains in places that there shouldn't have been mountains, and rivers running where rivers shouldn't run, and deserts next to, you know, jungles, and it was just kind of crazy. But you know what? I didn't care, and neither did my friends. Based on that one module, a whole narrative evolved of this queen who was seeking revenge on her people after she was betrayed and exiled. She went into the mountains, and deep within, she returned with a horde of ratmen. And these ratmen were called Skaloks. It really struck me like how crazy it was, because I'd never heard of Skaven from Warhammer's Old World. So the fact that the names of ratmen were so close was kind of crazy. Anyway, this queen and her ratmen army of Skaloks were seeking to get a magic item from these pyramids in this desert of Nagrathia, known as the Staff of Cardath, the Black Artificer. And, you know, the campaign was pretty awesome. And somewhere in a box, I still have that map written on a piece of graph paper and colored in with pencil crayons. And, you know, as silly as that map was and as silly as that campaign was, I don't have it in my heart to get rid of it. Now, here's the thing. How would I go about creating a campaign from scratch? Well, I think there's a few things that I want to address in your letter here. To start with, I think as tempting as it is, I wouldn't go about creating my own rule system just yet. I think that creating your own rule system is one of those tried and true kind of things that every game master will do at one point in their life. And I highly encourage you to take on the challenge. However, for starting something new, I probably wouldn't do that, just because as a noob, you're going to probably have a lot of things on your plate, and being a rules designer in addition to a referee is a lot of work. Let's make that distinction. There is a big distinction between being a rules designer versus being a adventure designer or a campaign designer. What I would recommend is that you choose a game system that matches your style of play, something that you might not necessarily know right now till you play a little bit, but I would recommend something like Shadowdark, because Shadowdark is a very simple system and it's very easy to understand and implement. In addition, I would say the 5th edition rules of Dungeons & Dragons would also be good. There's a little bit more complexity, but I don't think it's so much more that you wouldn't be able to handle it. The biggest piece of advice that I would have, or the biggest reason why I would choose 5th edition, is just because of its accessibility. 5th edition can be found pretty much everywhere, Amazon, bookstores, so everybody could get a copy of the main rulebook if they were so inclined to do so. Also, you could look into Karen 2nd edition. This is a very inexpensive game. It's very rules light and probably very easy to understand and implement at your table. If you want to be part of the older school, kind of, you know, go from the traditions of the older generations, old school essentials or white box fantastic medieval adventure game are also two really good choices. Old School Essentials is a little bit more expensive, but it's a very, very readable and usable set of rules. And White Box Fantastic Medieval Adventures comes from the same roots as OSE, but also very inexpensive to get a copy of. Those would be my two sort of recommendations, in the sense of like finding something that's very accessible and then also taking into consideration how much money do you want to spend on something like that. Now, assuming that you want to run a fantasy game, that's what I would choose. However, if you want to do a non-fantasy game, there are a lot of generic game systems or customized systems that you could use to represent that genre. For instance, science fiction, westerns, or, you know, horror. Some generic systems that I would recommend would be basic role-playing, so the engine that's behind the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game, GURPS, or Savage Worlds. Next, I think it's important to make a distinction between what's a campaign and what's an adventure. Using Lord of the Rings as an example, the Fellowship of the Ring, so the first book or the first movie, is roughly equivalent to an adventure, though perhaps it's a little on the long side. An adventure doesn't necessarily have to be long, it just needs to be long enough to encapsulate whatever the scenario requires. Now, a campaign, using that same example, would be the collection of all three of the Lord of the Rings books or movies. So each movie makes up, or each book makes up, one really long adventure, and the campaign is done at the end of the third book or movie, The Return of the King. When it comes to creating a world, I would argue that the best way is to start small. One of my favorite sources for world building comes from a column in Dragon Magazine, and it would be later printed in Dungeon Magazine. Sadly, these magazines are no longer available. However, if you go on to drivethroughrpg.com, which is a great resource for buying PDFs, there is the 4th edition era of Dungeon & Dragon magazine, which does have this column, and which is called Dungeon Craft. The original writer of Dungeon Craft, Ray Winninger, wrote Dragon Issue 256 of Dungeon Craft. The first rule of Dungeon Craft is to never force yourself to create more than you have to. In another seminal work called Red Tide, written by Kevin Crawford, which you can find on drivethroughrpg.com, Kevin Crawford writes, "The golden rule of sandbox prep is don't prepare it unless it's fun to make or you expect to need it in the next session." So I think that these two ideas encapsulate really what you need when it comes to gaming. Basically, don't go crazy and write a ton of stuff. You don't need to have a ton of stuff written to be able to play the game. You only need to write and prepare what you need for the campaign and the adventure now. Because if you do overwrite, you're going to burn out. And you're going to do a lot of preparation that isn't going to matter and is never going to be seen. Now, like I said, if you're having fun doing it, that's a different story. Now, another question might be, well, what is a sandbox? So I just want to give you the definition for what a sandbox is. And so you can think of a sandbox as sort of like a video game in terms of like Grand Theft Auto, Red Dead Redemption, or Skyrim. Essentially, a world that is limited, so the players can only go in a certain direction before they reach the end of the world, and allows them to have the experience of exploring as much as they want or following the storylines that interest them. And there's generally some sort of overarching plot, but that's not necessarily important for your game. Going back to Dragon 256 in his column Dungeon Craft, Ray Winninger says, and I quote, "You must choose whether you want to use a published AD&D setting or create one of your own," end quote. This brings up another interesting point where it's like, do you want to create something from scratch or do you want to use something that's already been written? And there are, you know, pros and cons for doing both. Some people enjoy the creativity and the freedom of being able to build their own worlds from the bottom up. And other people are like, hey, that's a lot of work, and I would rather use something where somebody has thought out a lot of these things. So that's something to take into consideration when you're going ahead. Assuming that you want to create your own setting, though, you're going to need some kind of a framework to base your world on. What do I mean by that? Well, for example, is your world a primitive land of dinosaurs? Or is it something based on Greek mythology? Or is it a completely different kind of a world where Eternal Night has taken over the land, surviving humans are hunted, and vampires rule? Each one of these kind of puts a different sort of context on how the world is perceived by you and your players and what will be in or not in that world. Assuming that your world has clerics or priests, you're going to want to think about how gods and divine magic work. At minimum, you'd probably need a list of gods that the different people could worship. And this is just one of those things where you start to realize that there's a lot that of thought that goes into world building and why you might want to consider using a pre-published world. In addition to thinking about clerics and divine magic and gods, you might want to consider about magic. Does your world have magic? Does it exist at all? For example, in the Dungeons & Dragons setting Dark Sun, magic is considered to be dangerous and evil, as it's the force that destroyed the world and led to it becoming a desert wasteland. While psionics, a different kind of power that is derived from mental energy, is something that is much more common in the setting. Another consideration is races and ancestries. Which ones exist? What are they like? For example, are there elves? Are there dwarves? Do only humans exist? For example, if you were playing in a swords and sorcery setting like Conan, there is only humans. What if you started your campaign and everyone was a hobbit? These sorts of things can fundamentally change the way your setting is. Having taken all that stuff into consideration, the tiniest building block of your world is going to be the adventure, and you're going to need something to kick off your campaign. Ideally, you want to start off with something small that's going to set the tone and the expectations of the campaign. The simplest way to do that would be to create a dungeon or a monster lair. Later, after this, or maybe even before, depending on the scenario, you might want to create a village where the characters are from, or where they've just arrived to, and basically be a home base. Some place where they can sleep, heal, buy and sell the stuff they have, and get rumors for the next adventure. But as I was saying, when it comes to building an adventure, the easiest solution is probably that of exploring a dungeon or a lair. And these are called site-based adventures. A site-based adventure can be broken down into various subcategories of exploration, the raid, where you're basically trying to go into a location and kill somebody or steal something, or where you need to defend a place from attackers. The other type of scenario would be the event-based scenario. These scenarios tend to be more about solving mysteries or reacting to some sort of event that has occurred in the world. And they tend to be a little bit more complicated to run and involve creating timelines, clues, and detailed NPCs. As you can see, there are a ton of things that go into the creation of a world, but the reward for doing so can be huge. It's for reasons like this that many people want to use pre-published settings like Forgotten Realms, Greyhawk, Dark Sun, or Ravenloft, just to name a few. Maybe you want to use a setting that's based on a book or a movie. For example, Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings. This especially gives everyone who has consumed that kind of media a touchstone at the table to understand what is your world about. Ultimately, this is a huge topic, and I would highly recommend that you go and look up the Alexandrian blog, read the Dungeon Master's Guide, or take a look on YouTube and Google. There are so many resources out there that I couldn't possibly be able to tell you them all. Ultimately, how you go about building a world and what you use and what you don't use is going to be your personal tastes and what you think might work or not work. As you gain more experience, you will learn what works and what doesn't work. I hope that helps. And if you have any further questions, please feel free to email, call in, and I'd be more than happy to expand on the topic. But that's all for this week, folks. So let me ask you, the listeners, a question. What would be your best advice or best source for somebody wanting to create their own world? I would like to thank everybody for listening. I would especially like to thank my callers, Carl Rodriguez from The Geomologist Presents, Che Webster from Roleplay Rescue, and Joe Richter from Hindsightless. I do not have a Patreon, but the best way that you can support me is to rate, review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and put a like or comment into the video on YouTube. It would mean a lot to me. I really would like to expand my content to a larger audience. So thanks. Music, as always, by Alexander Kizanaku. Cover art by the most gnarliest dude from the Pacific Northwest, John McNally. You can call in and leave a message at www.speakpipe.com/thedungeonplunger or send me an email at dungeonplunger, all at one word, at gmail.com. And remember, when you're plunging into the dungeon and nature calls, watch out for mimics disguised as toilets. They're a pain in the butt. Elbows up!